Alright, listen up, guys. Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, except the podcasting asshole sitting in his room recording this episode. Hello, hello, looters. Welcome to yet another special episode of Thieves Monthly Movie Loot. This is our third of these, after one on Seven and a second one on Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Like those first two, the loot is a specific scene from a film I love, which I'm gonna break apart and analyze and see why it works. I'm trying to do these special episodes every other month, so when I saw this one would fall in December, I knew right away I wanted to do a Christmas film, and what better option for it than, drumroll please, Die Hard. More specifically, I'm gonna talk about the scene where Hans Gruber questions Takagi about the code, but I might go off a bit rambling about the film in general. But first, for a bit of background and perspective from me, I saw Die Hard many, many moons ago, probably late 1980s. I think we saw it on TV or VHS, and I think all of us, my mom and my brother, saw it together. Nice family gathering. The thing is that I love it so much that I saw it repeatedly afterwards, be it whenever it was on TV or that we rented it to see it again and again. And no matter how many times I see it, I don't get tired of it. To this day, I consider it my favorite action film ever. Like with my previous special episode, this will be an in-depth discussion, so be warned, the film will be spoiled. If for some crazy reason you haven't seen Die Hard, what are you waiting for? Turn this off and go see it. As of now, it is streaming free on HBO Max. Also, after checking out this episode, make sure you look for episode 4 of Amy Smith's podcast, Film for Thought, where me and fellow podcaster John Reynolds join Amy in talking about the film. So let's begin.
It's Christmas Eve in L.A.
California.
Is Daddy coming home soon?
Well, we'll see what Santa and Mommy can do, okay?
A New York cop, John McLean, has come to see his wife.
I missed you.
Instead, he's going to have to save her.
Sit down.
Within this skyscraper high above the city, 12 terrorists have declared war.
They're about to be taught a lesson in the real use of power.
They're as brilliant.
Because I am interested in the $640 million in your vault.
As they are ruthless.
But I'm telling you, you're just going to have to kill me.
Okay. We do it the hard way.
Now, the last thing McLean wants.
Think, damn it, think.
Is to be a hero.
Where's Howie?
Hey, Tucker!
Where?
But he doesn't have a choice.
What does he think he's doing?
Job.
They have already killed one hostage.
This channel is reserved for emergency calls only.
There you go, I sound like I'm one of the pieces!
He's inside? Who is he?
Not on your side!
Who are you then? You are most troublesome for a security guard.
Sorry, wrong guess, huh? Would you like to go for double jeopardy?
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, mother...
You just destroyed a building.
And I am in charge of this situation.
Well, I got some bad news for you. From up here, that looks like you're in charge of Jack.
He is alone, he is tired, and he hasn't seen Diddly Squat from anybody down here.
Hey, pal, how you feeling?
The whole thing's being equal, I'd rather be in Philadelphia.
I want blood,
and you have it.
Only John can drive somebody that crazy.
He's an easy guy to like.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
And a hard man to kill. Bruce Willis. Die Hard.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
For those that have been living in a cave, Die Hard follows New York detective John McClane, played by Bruce Willis, who arrives to Los Angeles to meet with his estranged wife Holly, played by Bonnie Bedelia, during a Christmas party at her office building. Shortly after his arrival, a group of terrorists, led by Hans Gruber, played by Alan Rickman, take over the building, while McClane must try to fight them off alone. Aside from those three leads, the film also features supporting performances by Reginald Bell Johnson as Al Powell, the friendly cop that befriends McLean, Hart Buckner as Ellis, Holly's sleazy co-worker, and Paul Gleason as Deputy Chief of Police Dwayne T. Robinson. This was John McTiernan's third feature film after another successful 80s actioneer, the wildly successful Predator. Producers Lawrence Gordon and Joel Silver hired him precisely because of this, but according to an interview, McTiernan had some issues with the tone and before signing up said the following: "My principal concern going into this was that it was a story that concerned terrorists, and terrorist movies are usually mean, filled with all sorts of mean, nasty acts. And I didn't say yes to this project until we figure out some ways to put, in essence, some joy in it." Which brings me to the dreaded question of the time. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Now, this question is consistently and endlessly debated and argued over the internet and other media, with some people taking it in jest and good spirit and others not so much. So before we dive into the scene I mentioned, let's talk a bit about that. Now, like I said, McTiernan did want to instill the film with some Christmas joy. Writer Jeb Stuart said in an interview, "I can tell you for a fact that I intended it to be a Christmas movie." Co-writer Steven D'Souza has seconded that and even said that Die Hard was more of a Christmas film than 1954's White Christmas with Bing Crosby. On the other hand, the star of the film and certified Grinch, Bruce Willis, said in an interview that Die Hard wasn't a Christmas film, but that it was a goddamn Bruce Willis movie. Now, certainly some of these replies are meant to be tongue-in-cheek, while others I think are more serious, but like I said, this is an issue that many, many people are quite passionate about. So, since I'm such a fan of the film, I'm going to share my four reasons for why Die Hard is a Christmas film. Number 1. The setting. Die Hard takes place on Christmas Eve, with a man traveling to meet his wife and family during a Christmas party. Number 2. The motifs. There are several uses of Christmas elements and motifs in the set design and the props that end up being quite integral to the plot. There are decorations all around the office, there's a Santa hat that McLean puts on Tony's body, there's the huge Christmas tree in the floor where the party is being held, which you can see fall down as John is trying to escape towards the end of the film, there's the gift wrapping tape that McLean uses in the climatic encounter with Hans. All of those are integral elements that if we took off the film, it just wouldn't be the same. Number 3. The dialogue. The script is full of numerous quotes, lines, and conversations about Christmas, or at least Christmas-inspired, other than the expected Christmas chit-chat because, well, it's Christmas Eve. There are lots of lines that cling to the Christmas motif. You have McLean's message on Tony's sweater, "Now I have a machine gun, ho ho ho." You have Theo's story as SWAT tries to storm the building, "'Twas the night before Christmas." Hans and Theo make several Christmas references as they talk, but most notably they wish each other Merry Christmas when the vault opens, because that's their Christmas miracle. And number 4, the music. Finally, the music is heavily inspired on Christmas. Most, if not all, the songs used are holiday songs. McTiernan specifically asked composer Michael Kamen to use Beethoven's Ode to Joy, and although he was reluctant at first, McTiernan explained to him how the song was used by Stanley Kubrick in A Clockwork Orange to highlight the violence, so Kamen understood what McTiernan was going for and agreed. Kamen also integrated bits of Winter Wonderland and Singing in the Rain into his score. There's also the constant use of those sleigh bells all through the film, and the film of course ends with Let It Snow. Also, there's the unorthodox rap song that Argyle puts in the limo, Christmas in Hollis from Run-DMC, and I don't know if this was intentional or not, but this song can be taken as a statement on the film as well, because as soon as Argyle puts it, McLean scoffs and asks him, "Don't you have any Christmas music?" To which he replies, "This is Christmas music," and then the lyrics start and we realize it actually is. Unorthodox and not what we would expect, but a Christmas song nevertheless. Which we can say about the film as well. Unorthodox and not what we would expect from a Christmas film, but a Christmas film nevertheless. But anyway, at the end of the day, the argument is just semantics. People can just label the film in whatever way they want, and it doesn't change how others label it as well. I obviously have no issues in considering it a Christmas film, and have made a point of watching it at least once every year around Christmas time. One of the things that perhaps make people not think of it as a Christmas movie is its adult themes. I mean, there's marital conflicts, terrorists, a cocaine addict, explosions, cussing, and of course, people getting shot left and right. And one of the first murders is the one we're going to talk about, and that's Joseph Takagi, Holly's boss. This scene occurs at roughly half hour into the film and puts into motion the overall events of it. In analyzing that scene, I'm going to talk about three things. Number one, setup.
So Kareem rebounds, right? Feeds Worthy on the break, over to AC, to Magic, then back to Worthy, right? Boom! 2 points. We're in.
Like I said, this scene occurs very early in the film after we've met most of the main characters, including Takagi, who we've seen seems to be a pretty laid-back and affable boss, but also the conflict between McLean and his wife has been established. There's a pretty cool shot that leads into the scene I'm going to talk about, which is when we see the terrorists drive into the parking of Nakatomi Building, and you know, they arrive in two vehicles, Theo and Carl are in a sedan, a car, and the rest are in a big truck. As they enter Nakatomi, there's a great simple shot that follows both vehicles as they turn the curb, and the camera is right beside the sedan with the truck in the background, and you see how the truck suddenly submerges into the underground parking, which I think is a fabulous shot. Hard to describe in audio, but it looks really, really cool. Then you have two groups to follow. And there's a great use of misdirection here because you have Theo and Carl arriving at the main lobby while the others wait on the underground parking. And we're kind of going back and forth, dreading, waiting, what's going to happen where? Is shit going down in the parking or is shit going down in the lobby? And there's the great distraction of Theo with the whole basketball game talk and bang, Carl shoots the receptionist, which is a great moment. It's the moment where we really go, oh shit. And he radios the guys in the parking and they back up the truck into a loading ramp. And there's this other great shot as you see the terrorists pull up the truck door and you see them walking out with the camera right in front of them. And it's a great shot because you see them swarm out and there's this menace and this attitude in each of them that you know they mean business. But especially this is when we meet Hans Gruber, played by Alan Rickman. As they all walk out carrying duffel bags and weapons, Hans walks out right down the middle, very well dressed, overcoat on, hands in his pocket, and he looks so slick, so cool, that you immediately know this is the guy. This whole sequence is easily one of my favorite moments on the film. And from this sequence on, they do a great job of establishing who Hans is and how he operates. He's calm and methodical, he's cool and collected, but you also see how each of the bad guys has a mission, a purpose. Theo is dealing with the computers and the elevators, Carl is the main henchman, he's dealing with the other security guard, Eddie is taking the receptionist spot, Tony goes down to the basement to cut the phones, the others start loading the big weapons and the rocket launchers. It's a great way to establish that these guys know what they're doing, they've come prepared, and they're not bullshitting around. It helps build up the dread about what's bound to happen here, which leads me to my second point, performances.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to the Nakatomi Corporation's legacy of greed around the globe, they are about to be taught a lesson in the real use of power. You will be witnesses. Now, where is Mr. Takagi?
Joseph Yoshinobu Takagi. Born Kyoto, 1937.
So as Hans and his people go up to the party and they take over, terrorists are shooting around, dragging people out, everybody's scared, McLean manages to sneak out, and once again, you see how calm and collected Hans is. He walks to the front with his little notebook in hand, gentlemen, gentlemen. But the thing is that Rickman is so good. You see, this film was released in 1988, and it came at a point where the typical action film bad guy was perhaps loud and cartoonish, scenery-shooing assholes, compare Hans to Bennett in Commando or maybe Gary Busey in Lethal Weapon. Hans is not that kind of villain. He's cool, suave, slick, calm, courteous, educated, even friendly. It's the kind of bad guy that you might even root for. And the surprising thing is that this was Alan Rickman's feature film debut. He was already an established theater actor and was hired by producer Joel Silver after he saw him perform on Broadway's version of Dangerous Liaisons. So by the time we see Hans call for Takagi, we know they're dangerous, but we're not really sure how dangerous he is. He presents himself to be courteous, friendly, and very much unlike any villain we've seen so far. So we don't necessarily feel the threat. Maybe someone who saw the film now would be more aware and alert, but in 1988 this was mostly new ground. Then we see him with Takagi in the elevator, humming Christmas songs and chatting him up about fashion and industrialization. All this conversation that goes up in the hall is so great because not only does it continue to establish the kind of bad guy that Hans is, but it also serves as some sort of distraction about his motives.
When Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer. Benefits of a classical education. Oh, that's beautiful. I always enjoyed to make models when I was a boy. The exactness, the attention to every conceivable detail. It's beautiful.
Is this what this is all about? Our project in Indonesia? Contrary to what you people may think, you're going to develop that region, not exploit it.
I believe you.
I read the article in Forbes.
Mr. Takagi, I could talk about industrialization and men's fashions all day, but I'm afraid work must intrude, and my associate Theo has some questions for you. Sort of fill in the blanks questions, actually.
So at this point, we're there just like Takagi, wondering what they're up to. Is this about a project in Indonesia? On the other hand, we have McLean, played by Bruce Willis, and from the get-go, he's also established as an ordinary guy. The role of John McLean was offered to probably about 100 actors at the time. For example, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, Richard Gere, Clint Eastwood, Harrison Ford, Burt Reynolds, Nick Nolte, Mel Gibson, Don Johnson, Richard Dean Anderson, Paul Newman, and James Caan. All of those already established action stars, big macho stars. However, the role ended up with Bruce Willis, which was an odd choice since he was primarily known as a comedic actor, which is part of the interesting aftermath of the film. Because you have these two actors, Willis and Rickman, from such different backgrounds, one in comedy, the other in theater, both hired to play against each other in this action film, and both end up delivering not only iconic career-defining performances, but genre-defining performances. But back to Willis, from the get-go he's established as an everyman, he's a detective but he's dealing with a failed marriage and he seems like a bit of a sourpuss. I mean, he's even afraid of flying. In addition, it's established that he's out of his element. From the moment he steps out of the plane, you see how uncomfortable he feels. A couple is kissing and hugging near him, he's awkward with his limo driver. When he arrives at the party, he's underdressed, he doesn't like the drinks, he doesn't like the people around him, and Willis portrays that uncomfortability perfectly. He's out of his element, and this notion of putting a regular guy in the hero role helps to heighten danger and makes you wonder if he's actually gonna make it. He's on his undershirt, he doesn't have his shoes, which the film often reminds us of, he only has his gun, whereas we've already seen how prepared the bad guys are. So on one side you have this scruffy looking cop with no shirt and no shoes that can't even hold a decent conversation with his wife, and on the other hand you have this well-dressed, slick-looking terrorist that always seems to have the right words. Easy to surrender and let go, but for someone like McLean, there's no question about it, he has to step up, which leads me to my third point, the meeting.
I don't have that code.
You broke in here to access our computer?
Any information you could get when they wake up in Tokyo in the morning, they'll change it. You won't be able to blackmail our executive, threaten our profit.
Sit down.
Mr. Takagi, I'm really not interested in your computer. But I need the code key because I am interested in the $640 million in negotiable bearer bonds that you have locked in your vault. And the computer controls the vault.
You want money? What kind of terrorists are you?
Who said we were terrorists?
As McLean is running and hiding through the stairwells, assessing the situation, Hans and his men bring Takagi to a luxurious hall where Hans admires the models of some of Nakatomi's infrastructure projects. This helps to further the notion that Hans is an educated man and not the impulsive bad guy that we might expect. He then leads Takagi to a conference room where they reveal their true intentions. What Hans and his men want is to gain access to the high security vault in the building where they store millions of dollars in bearer bonds. But to gain access to the vault, they need the code. This starts a game of wits between Takagi and Hans, as the former insists that they'll gain nothing with the code, since it will only give them partial access, and that the Japan headquarters would quickly change it and whatnot. Now, I love everything about the scene, but it always makes me laugh the way Hans reacts when Takagi realizes they're there for the money and asks, "What kind of terrorist are you?" And Hans laughs and says, "Who said we were terrorists?" That feels so genuine in the midst of such a threatening situation that it always makes me smile. But more important than the actual exchange is the way the scene unfolds, not only because of the dialogue, but for the performances, verbal and non-verbal, and the way everything escalates. Once again, you see the calm and collected Hans, but this time he has a gun. This whole scene is a spectacle of non-verbal acting, as you see the way Hans calmly removes the silencer from his gun and puts it on the table. Meanwhile, you can see Takagi is keeping his shit together, but he's nervous and sweating, and the back and forth is great because you can see that Hans has all the necessary replies and answers to shoot back at all of Takagi's excuses.
The code, please.
Useless to you. There are 7 safeguards on our vault, and the code key is only one of them. You'll never get it open.
Then there's no reason not to tell it to us.
I told you.
It's not over yet.
It's a very nice suit, Mr. Takagi. To be ashamed to ruin it. I'm going to count to 3. There will not be a 4. Give me the code. 1, 2, 3.
I don't know it, I'm telling you. Get on the jet to Tokyo and ask the chairman. I'm telling you, you're just gonna have to kill me.
Okay.
We do it the hard way. Tony, see if you can dispose of that. Carl, you better go and check on Heinrich's work up on the machine floor.
In the meantime, you can see McLean approaching the conference room, hiding, trying to see what's happening and what he can do, and he's also not sure yet of how serious these guys are. He knows they came armed and prepared, but he still hasn't seen them kill anybody. So as the conversation escalates, Hans starts his count to 3, while Takagi puts his foot down and bang! It's a great moment because it helps to cement the severity of the situation and how far they're willing to go for the goal. In terms of direction, McTiernan does 2 great things here. He does the zoom shot with McLean's face as he sees what happened, and he also puts the camera behind Takagi as his body falls down in the foreground and you see Hans in the background standing up and say, "We'll do it the hard way." It's a great scene that helps establish who these guys really are and what is McLean fighting against. One final thing about the scene, and it's actually one of the things I like the most, is the exchange between Carl and Theo. As soon as Hans begins to question Takagi and he refuses to give them the code, Theo says, "I told you," and Carl replies, "It's not over yet." Hans looks at them, actually puzzled, but continues his questioning of Takagi, and right after he shoots him, you see Carl hand Theo a dollar bill, which means they had a bet on what would happen. It's such a small detail that's not only both funny, but it also helps to show that these guys don't care about human life to the point that they're willing to bet money on it. So, those are my thoughts on that excellent scene. I think it does a great job of presenting who these terrorists are and what is McClane fighting against. It sets up that Hans is indeed a killer, that he's not afraid to shoot, and that he likes to play with his victims, you know, counting down to three, all of which will come back later in the film. But I know this is not the only great scene in the film. Die Hard is full of great and memorable moments, so I asked my friends on Twitter to let me know what is their favorite moment from the film, and this is what I got. First, my friend Ken at InterKen said, "My favorite scene in Die Hard is when John McClane captures Hans Gruber at gunpoint, and Hans, banking on the hope that John doesn't know what he looks like, pretends to be one of the hostages, so John will let his guard down, which he does. John gives Hans a gun, and Hans immediately points it at him, only to find that John had taken the bullets out of it before giving it to him. It's this rapid exchange of chess pieces that makes Die Hard more than just an action movie. It's really a battle of wits." End quote. Cool trivia about the scene. That was not in the original script, but producer Joel Silver wanted a scene between McClane and Gruber before the film's climax. Writer De Souza couldn't think of any way to meet them until he heard Rickman's American accent while talking to a crew member. That's how they figured that they could come up with a scene where Hans could pretend to be a hostage alongside McClane. But anyway, you write about your thoughts. Like I just discussed in my breakdown, Die Hard is not a conventional action film with a strong macho hero. As a matter of fact, you only see McClane fight twice in the film. First with Tony after he sets off the alarm, and this is not an elegant fight, it's a scuffle, and in the end with Carl, which is actually a more proper fight. The rest of the film is, like Ken said, a battle of wits as McClane tries to outsmart and outrun the terrorist. My friend Ron at RDavidOnTheWire said, "The movie is too chock full of great scenes and lines to narrow it down and offered a varied selection of great lines."
"Attention, whoever you are. This channel is reserved for emergency calls only."
"No fucking shit, lady! Do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?"
"So you take this under advisement, jerkweed."
"I've got 100 people down here, and they're covered with glass."
"Glass? Who gives a shit about glass? Who the fuck is this?"
"You listen to me, you little asshole. I'm a..."
"Asshole? I'm not the one who just got butt-fucked on national TV, Dwayne."
Great lines of dialogue all. Also, my friend Jolene at JMR_18 also came up with the line about ordering a pizza, but added McClane's next retort as the 911 woman threatens him.
"If this is an emergency call, dial 911 on your telephone. Otherwise, I'll have to report this as an FCC violation."
"Fine, report me. Come the fuck down here and arrest me. Just send the police now."
Also, my friend Tom at Deaf Heaven mentions one of my favorite lines, which is Ellie's speech to the terrorist. "Hans, booby, I'm your white knight." Some trivia about that line. It was improvised by Hart Buckner, which is amazing. And finally, my friend John Reynolds at JohnReyno42 says, "When Hans falls off Nakatomi Plaza." And it's such an iconic moment. That image of Rickman falling in slow motion has become the equivalent of Christmas. I'm sure you've all seen the meme that says it isn't Christmas until you've seen Hans Gruber fall off Nakatomi Plaza. Some trivia about that moment: Rickman was actually dropped in a soundstage from a disputed height of 20 to 70 feet. It's not clear. McTiernan convinced Rickman to perform the stunt by dropping himself first into a bunch of card boxes. When they were filming the scene, McTiernan told Rickman they would drop him at the count of three, but drop him earlier to get a genuine look of surprise. Although they filmed a second take, they ended up using the first one. So that's all for today. Thanks so much for listening to this special episode of Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. If you like this breakdown and have any thoughts to share, look me up on Twitter at my personal account at ThiefCGT, ThiefCGT, or the podcast account at TMML2021. You can also look me up on Letterboxd as Thief12 and we can see what we're seeing. Also, stay tuned for my next regular episode to close 2020, which will come out later in December, because...
this is their idea of Christmas, I gotta be here for New Year's.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It doesn't show signs of stopping, and I brought some corn for popping. The lights are turned way down low. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.